everyone. Last time we ended off with a bit of a question, which is, how is it that one understands the nature of the requirement to study Maisa Bereishis or Maisa Merkava, if it's not a requirement in a formal sense, the fact that the Gemara compares it to Davar Gadol versus Davar Katan, and we saw the approach of the Rambam, that Davar Gadol, Maisa Merkava, refers to philosophy and our ability to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the study of philosophy. We noted that there are other ways that the Gemara and Bava Basra could be understood. We cited, for example, the Ritva. We saw the approach of halachic man, that one connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu not so much through the study of esoteric wisdom, whether or not that studying HaKadosh Baruch Hu through philosophy or through mysticism, but rather through, none left. If you email me, anyone who didn't get a packet, because they weren't here last week, or they were, should email me and I will send you a copy of it. I'm sorry, I don't have any more printed copies. That we connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through studying halacha. There is another interesting approach to this, but I think now, actually, especially because we're starting late and I want to make sure we get through our central point for today, I'd like to turn to a continuation of the discussion, not that particular point, and that is the role of philosophy. So we saw the Rambam write last week that through philosophy one is able to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu and thereby fulfill mitzvot like Anochi, Lo Yiyah, Shema Yisrael, Avas Hashem and Yir Shemayim. As you certainly know, there were, not everybody agreed with the Rambam's position concerning philosophy. The Maimonidean controversies that revolved around the permissibility of the study of philosophy engulfed numerous Jewish communities more or less from the year 1180 to the year 1235. And then they once again reignited and perhaps really continued until around the year 1305, so more than 100 years. Finally, at that point, the Ramban first sort of quieted the controversy to some degree by acknowledging Rambam's greatness, even as one might disagree with his approach to philosophy. In 1305, the Rashba led a ban, a cherem, and many Spanish rabbis signed along with him, prohibiting the study of Greek philosophy. If you want to read that ban, it's found in the Tshuva Sarashba, and it's in your source sheets. I don't think we'll read it together, but basically the conclusion is you can't study Greek philosophy if you're less than 25. It's Tshuva Sarashba, Chelek Aleph, Tuf Tes Vav. What's interesting is he didn't create a lifetime ban against the study of philosophy, and he didn't include things like Mor Nevuchim, in other words, Jewish books of philosophy. He also didn't include the study of medicine or perhaps science. But generally speaking, when we look at, there are a number of issues that come here. So one question is, what did Chazal have to say about philosophy? What did they think about philosophy? So there's not much explicit in Chazal on the topic of philosophy. There are a couple of places in Shas, again you have them over here, where the Gemara refers to Chachmas Yevanis. It refers to it negatively, it would seem. There's an Isser to teach your son Chachmas Yevanis. Rabbi Yishmael says basically it's a waste of time. V'yigisa bel yomam v'layla, so you should study Torah day and night. So if you want to study Chachmas Yevanis, find a time that's neither day nor night. However, if you look at the Mefarshim as to what Chachmas Yevanis over there means, it doesn't seem like it's actually talking about Greek wisdom or philosophy or science the way we would normally think of Chachmas Yevanis. The story over there about how they used Chachmas Yevanis to communicate to each other to send a pig up the rod at the Beis HaMikdash. Take a look at the Makoros and you'll see the way Rashi and Tosfos and the Maharal, for example, take a look at Nesivos Olam on Torah Perek Yudalid. Again, you have this in your source sheets. Don't seem to assume that when the Gemara means Chachmas Yevanis, it's really referring to philosophy. There is a place in Shabbos.
What does it refer to, actually?
It's referring to a type of communication. I'll read you the Gemara. You have it over here. Tan Rabbanan kishetzaru malchei beis chashmonai zel zeh v'hayahorkonus mibachutz v'aristabulus mibifnim v'chol yom v'yom hayu mishalshalin lahan dinarin v'kupa. So right, there was the civil war, and even though they were waging war with each other, those on the outside of the Beis HaMikdash would still value the bringing of the Karban Tamid, and therefore Hayu Mishal Shalin Lahan Dinarin Bekupa Omalin Lahan Tmidin, so they would send down money and bring up Karbanos. Hayolam Zakin Echach Haya Makir B'Chachmas Yevanis Laaz Lahan B'Chachmas Yevanis Amr Lahan Kozman Shasukin B'Avoda Ein Nimsarin B'Yedchen. So he communicated to them using Chachmas Yevanis that as long as you are asukin be'avoda, in other words, you allow them to continue to bring the Karban Tamid, you will not succeed in conquering them. L'machar shilshulam dinarim bekupa ve'elu lahem chazir. Kevan shigia l'chati choma not tziparnaf b'choma. The chazir put its nails into the wall surrounding Har Habayis. V'nizdaza eretz Yisrael arba meos parsa arba meos parsa. Doesn't sound like he's talking about Aristotle, and it doesn't seem like he's even talking about philosophy. It's talking about some type of connection. So Rashi and Menachos understands it's referring to Ramazim, Tosfos and Menachos, and the Meiri, and the Rambam, and the Tashbates say it's some type of communication, not a form of philosophy per se. If you look at the Shita Mekubetis of Bava Kamma, it's three interpretations. But again, it doesn't seem to be a general. The way the Ra'aral puts it is Nira de Chachmas Yevanis de Hasam Ayri Chachmas She'en La Shaychos Ala Taraklal Kemo Chachmas Shibim Melitza O Mashal. And he says later, Mepneki Davar Zeh Ein Bo To'eles Lahavin Chachmas Atora Ulakach Asura Val Divrei Chachma Eino Aser Ki A Chachma Zosi Kemo Sulam Lalos Ba El Chachmas HaTorah. So it's not clear, certainly doesn't sound like that Chazal here mean to prohibit philosophy the way we usually think of the term. Again, the Gemara in Shabbos on Kuf Tes Vav Amud Aleph, sorry, Kuf Tes Zayin, has a story about a corrupt judge who's a philosopher. He's philosopha, Mishavuse de Shakil, but basically that Gemara is just referring to a corrupt judge. If you look at Rashi and Tosos and Rabbeinu Hananel over there, there are a number of interpretations. What exactly philosopha means? Again, it's not referring to someone who is a philosopher in the general sense. It's hard to look at Chazal explicitly and see from Chazal a negative attitude or a prohibition against the study of philosophy. But a much more powerful critique against the approach of the Rambam emerges not from the explicit statements in Chazal, but really from their silence and their apparent disinterest in philosophy. Or to put it differently, if it is so important to study philosophy, why don't we have a tradition of philosophy? Why doesn't the Gemara talk about it? Why aren't the types of issues that the Rambam deals with in Mar Nevuchim, or Rabbeinu Bachin, Chovos Halavavos, or Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, or the like, those types of questions dealt with explicitly in Chazal? One early thinker that sort of presented this question is the Riaz in Sanhedrin. You have it here again on your source sheets. And here he's talking about a slightly different but certainly related issue. The Rambam's view, as we'll have a chance to see later, is that anyone who believed that God has a guf of any sort is a heretic and has no Olam Haba and the like, is excluded from Klal Yisrael. And the question is, if that's so pashat, then why isn't that more explicitly stated in Chazal? And we'll return to this question b'harchava, but it's certainly a point that we have to consider. In other words, the Rambam spends a lot of time and effort describing how religiously problematic a corporeal conception of the Ribono Shel Olam is, and proving that this is so, and explaining the psukim that imply otherwise, why they're really not to be understood simply. So if this is such an important thing that every single Jew has to know, to have a chelek in Olam Haba, to be considered Jewish, so one would have expected it to be dealt with more explicitly in Chazal. So take a look at the Riaz. You have it over here. Where is it? Does anyone have the page yet? It's page 10 is the Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Menachos is page 11. The Maharal is at the footnote on the bottom of page 11, and the Riaz has been maliciously removed from your source sheets by someone who clearly wants you to study philosophy, and so he's taken it out and perhaps accidentally copied it and pasted it into some other place here, which is hidden, because when you're dealing with philosophical topics, things have to be done by remiza. So they can't be stated explicitly. So, unfortunately, I don't know where it is, actually. So, we'll have to you'll have to listen as I read it. Sanhedrin Sadi Aleph Amud Aleph. It's in his Kuntros Harayos. You could find it also quoted in the Shilta Giborim and in the Sefer Kadmai, if you want to look in the Shitos Kadmai. Okay, v'chein hadavar yadua l'chol chachmei lev, aval mi sheyite bekach v'lo yered l'amko shel davar umevin hamikros kipshutan v'savar shakadosh baruch hu bal tmuna lo nikramin shim kein hu hadavar eich lo pirsim ha-Torah al davar zeh v'lo gilu chachmei ha-Talmud l'hodiya davar zeh Kigalos ulihizaher nashim v'ame haaret shelo yuhu avudin olaman. Avudin olaman. In other words, exactly what we said, that this is a mistake that's easy to make, and therefore, how could Chazal not have made this point? Halokama isurim kalim kigon isur mukso kiyotze ba chibru chachamim kama halachos v'hirbu kama diktukin lahamid kol davar al mechono v'al davar zeh Shekol ha'emuna tluya bo, v'yesh bo kares ba'olam hazeh, v'olam haba, eich lo horu chachamim al davar zeh begalui? Elevadai lo ikbidu lakach, eliyamin adam ha'yichud kefi sichlo, v'afilu anashim kefi miut sichlam, sh'amer Moshe alav ha'shalom shma Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, u'mashma'u lashon shmua, v'lashon kabbalah, sh'al pi shmua v'al pi kabbalah yamin davar zeh. V'lo nasan Moshe Torah Yisrael ela b'derech emuna v'derech kabbalah. V'chol chachmei ha-mishnah v'chachmei ha-talmud lo nis'asku ela b'derech kabbalah u'v'derech emuna v'lo horu lidrosh v'lachkor al ha'inyan ha'alokus v'lo al inyan shar chachmos klal v'im hayu yechidim shahayu b'kiyim bahem lo hayu morin bahen l'rabim shelo tzivsa Torah l'horos al eila hadvarim. So there are really a lot of points here, and we'll have a chance to address a number of these points in coming shiurim as well. One issue is, what should the basis of emunah be? Should it be based off of proof, or should it be based off of tradition? Here the Riaz says, clearly tradition. If there was a need for proof, then Chazal would have proven it for us. Another question is how to read the psukim concerning Hashem's corporeality. And again, while the Riaz believes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was certainly incorporeal, he says that you see that belief in that incorporeality can't be an Iker Emunah, because if it was, Chazal would have told us more about it. Now, what would the Rambam respond to some of these critiques? So we'll have a chance again to return to the issue of corporeality when we talk about the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah. And the Rambam actually does believe that Chazal and Psukim do address this point. In fact, the Rambam thinks that there are many Psukim, Ki Lo Ra'isim Tmuna, there are many Psukim that explicitly make the point that a corporeal understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is false. And there's Chazals that highlight this as well. So his specific questions we'll return to a little later. But I'd like to discuss the more basic question, which I think does need to be considered, which is that if it is the case that Chazal believed that studying philosophy is important, and in fact it's something that they did, if that's what's meant by Maisa Merkava, so it's something that Chazal did engage in, so then why is it that we don't find this being stated explicitly? Why don't we have philosophical texts that come to us from Chazal? Why is it that we have to turn to the Greeks to understand so many of these basic ideas if in fact they're so important? So, in terms of that question, first of all, the Rambam does understand that that was a concern of Chazal, and in fact, he explains many midrashim to be referring to philosophical concepts. And perhaps in the coming weeks, we'll have the chance to look through cases where the Rambam does this. Mar Nevuchim is full of explanations of Psukim and explanations of Gemara that are philosophical explanations. So, in fact, it is not the case that Chazal did not engage in these types of things. Now, why, though, aren't there more overt explications of philosophy? So the Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim that Chazal actually did originally have a tradition of philosophy. However, and we find that Shlomo HaMelech, for example, refers to these works. However, they were not written down because of the prohibition against writing down the oral law. And anything, all Chachmas HaTorah that's not Tarsha Bichsav, cannot be written down. And that's why Mishnah, the Halacha, really nothing was written down other than that which was part of the Tarsha Bichsav. Now, we know that there was a fear that the oral law was to be forgotten, and this is what prompted Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi to write down the Mishnayos and later the Gemara and the like. And really, that's something that should not have been permitted, but it was allowed for Eis Laso Slashem, Hefiros Asecha, and the like. However, that would not have justified writing down the philosophical aspects, and that's because these are things that, in fact, it is usher to teach publicly. The Mishnah and Chagiga lays out the rules by which one is allowed to teach esoteric wisdom, and it can't be taught publicly. Not all students are ra'oi. You have to have mastered Torah beforehand. It could even then, if you find a student who is ra'oi, can't be taught except one-on-one, and even then it can't be taught overtly, only Roshe Prakim, and one must extrapolate the rest. So it would have been usher, at least to explicitly write this material down. Now, of course, this raises a question. Could the Rambam do it? And the Rambam addresses this question at length in his Hakdama to Mor Nevuchim, and we'll do that Be'ezras Hashem next week. But essentially what the Rambam argues was that due to persecution, a lot of our Chachma was in fact forgotten. You'll find a similar thing at the beginning of Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh with respect to the laws of intercalation and astronomy. And so, because it was forgotten due to persecution and because there wasn't the opportunity to codify it and write it to ensure that it wouldn't be forgotten, so indeed much of it was forgotten. And therefore we have to retrieve it. Now, the godless of philosophy is something that is nitan to understand through the seichel, and therefore can be recreated. It could be recollected. Lemashal, the Gemara talks about how many halachos were forgotten during the days of Avelos for Moshe Rabbeinu, and Asniel ben Kenaz restored them, but Pilpulo, using his Seichel, using his Chachma. And likewise, if aspects of Emes and Torah, in fact, were forgotten due to persecution and the like, they can be created, recreated, rediscovered through philosophizing, through thinking, through contemplation, and assessing their truth. And moreover, the Rambam says that it makes sense to turn to Aristotle and to the Greeks because Kabbalah Sa'emes Mimisha Amaro, that's Rambam's famous statement towards the beginning of Shmona Prakim. And there he writes one of the reasons why I turn to non-Jewish sources is because if it's true, it's true. It doesn't matter who said it. And therefore, to go ahead and use tools like Aristotle to help us recreate and arrive at the truth is absolutely valid. Now, one could raise an obvious question, which is, well, one second. But isn't it the case that Aristotle's perspective is fundamentally opposed to that of the Torah? Isn't it a totally different outlook? Torah bagayim altamin? Maybe Chachma bagayim, but not Torah. Why is it right to look to Aristotle? And to this, the Rambam basically seems to be saying that with respect to purely philosophical matters, there does seem to be significant compatibility between Torah and philosophy. So you take a look. This is from Mor Nevuchim 325, and it's on page 11. The idea that I was saying that Chazal once studied philosophy and that wisdom was forgotten is from 171 on the top of page 11. Right, know that many branches of science relating to the correct solution of these problems were once cultivated by our forefathers, but in the course of time was neglected. And finally, the paragraph that I want to show you now is about the general compatibility is in the middle of page 11, where it says, in Mor Nevuchim 325, when you examine this view and that of the philosophers, taking into consideration all the preceding chapters that are connected with the subject, you will find that there is no difference of opinion as regards any portion of the universe except that the philosophers believe in the eternity of the universe and we believe in creation. So Aristotle believed in the eternity of matter, the rejection of Ria Yesh Me'ayin, but rather matter, which makes up the universe, always existed. He doesn't deny the existence of God, but he does deny the notion that God created matter. And therefore, from this paragraph, you get the impression that, except for maybe some minor details, there's significant compatibility. The quote that we started off with on the first source from his Perusha Mishnayos and Brachos makes a similar point concerning other matters. And therefore, it's not really a problem to turn to Greek sources. It's sort of not like the impression that you get that there's this major diversion and discrepancy and the like. So, and basically says, even though a lot of people have the perception that there are contradictions between Torah and philosophy, that's either because they misunderstand Torah or they misunderstand philosophy. And the goal of Mor Nevuchim is written to a student who feels that there are these major contradictions. He goes ahead and he studied philosophy, he studied some Torah, he doesn't see how they could be resolved. And the Rambam's thesis is basically that they are and can be resolved, and they're both MS, and sometimes perhaps the contradiction stems from your misunderstanding the Torah. So I'm going to show you how to correctly understand the Torah. So for example, in the first 40 or 50 chapters of Mor Nevuchim, he goes through various psukim that sound like they imply that there's a corporeal God, and says, no, you're misunderstanding these psukim. And sometimes they stem from a misunderstanding of philosophy. Sometimes there are disagreement. We'll talk more about it, let's say, with respect to Briyas HaOlam. But even then, with respect to Briyas HaOlam, he points out that the reason why we reject the philosopher's view, at least one of them, is because their view has not even been proven. There is no proof. Aristotle could not prove the eternity of matter, and in fact he thinks that the more compelling argument, even from a science and philosophy perspective, is that matter is not eternal. So while it is true that we reject it based off of Torah, it's not just based off of Torah. We'll return to that point because Rambam says a number of nuanced things in that discussion, but that's basically what the Rambam says. So the first approach, and I would like to two perhaps general approaches to how to see the Rambam's relationship with Greek philosophy. One approach is that basically Aristotle got things right, and while certainly it is the case that if there is a contradiction between Torah and Aristotle, we will accept Torah. So the example of the acceptance of Brias Yesh Me'ayin and the rejection of the eternity of matter. But for the most part, Rambam does accept Greek philosophy, and that's because he sees it as compatible with the Torah. Now, we're not even going to talk about a certain academic school. Maybe next week we'll talk about it. That maintains that Rambam didn't actually believe in the Torah, and he believed in Aristotle, and even though he says everything to the contrary, he didn't really mean what he says. What he meant was something different than he says. And if you really know how to read the Rambam, you'll know to never believe anything he writes. But we'll talk about maybe who says that and why they say that and why it's wrong. But for now, we're going to reject that approach. And the first approach we're going to consider, what we've been saying basically, is that the Rambam felt that there was compatibility. Just to quote one great thinker on this topic, Rabbi Dr. Isidore Twersky, Rav Meir Twersky's father. So he in his many works on the topic, powerfully expresses this. The way he puts it was, the Rambam's goal was to bring law, or Torah, and philosophy, two apparently incongruous attitudes of mind, two jealous rivals, into fruitful harmony. And that was the approach of the Rambam. Now, I'd like to present a different perspective on the Rambam. We're going to see it in the writings of Rav Kook, but we'll perhaps see others who make this case as well. And it's a very interesting idea, quite different, but before getting there, let me take, I saw there a bunch of questions. Yes?
Is this just with Greek philosophy, or is this even modern-day philosophy? Would the Rambam think we could use it?
Well, I can't say what the Rambam would think about modern-day philosophy, because he didn't read it. But fundamentally, the approach that the Rambam had is that accept truth from he who says it, and if it's true, meaning to say it could be proven and demonstrated and the like, then it is true. And a person, a human being, should trust our intellect. In other words, God gave us the skills to arrive at the truth independently using our seichel. Our seichel is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, if the arguments being made by modern day philosophy are compelling, and they are not at odds with the Torah, then why wouldn't you accept it? If that's the reason why we accept Greek philosophy to the extent that we accept it, so the same thing would be true for any philosophy. And even referring to Greek is sort of somewhat of an oversimplification. Rambam certainly was a very big fan of Aristotle, but it's not just Aristotle. First of all, it was the many commentaries and interpretations of Aristotle. Rambam lived in an age when there were many great Muslim philosophers who furthered the understanding of Aristotle and what was actually Aristotle and what was them is a question, but not really relevant to our discussion. So the Rambam was certainly studying the modern philosophy of his time. It wasn't, you know, Aristotle didn't have a monopoly on wisdom, and it's not like there was nothing that came after him, though certainly he was, in Rambam's perspective, the greatest and achieved the went farther than anybody else before or after him. But it's not like he's the only one that has anything interesting to say.
This Rambam's sort of painting of history, that there was a forgetting of philosophical knowledge.
Rambam, by the way, isn't the only one that said that. The Rama, among others, has this idea as well.
Is that really historically?
I'm not a historian, and I'm not going to to question that for now. The Rambam felt it's true, and the Rambam felt that the fact that you don't see them talk about it is not a raya. There is clearly, like the Rambam writes, Shlomo HaMelech refers to chachma that isn't being presented, and there are references to esoteric wisdom. And it's true that these are things that could not be written down or could be publicized and the like. So I don't think, if you are a historian, you're going to say that's a ridiculous claim, because you're going to say that we have no evidence to the existence of such things, so therefore we're going to assume that it's not true. What the Rambam would say is that you shouldn't expect to see historical evidence to the existence of such things, because there's a prohibition against writing them down. And if you understand that, you know, the Rambam's interpretation of even Chazal is correct, and we'll have a chance to see how the Rambam sees and interprets Midrashim and Chazal statements, certainly in Psukim and the like, in philosophical terms. So if that's correct, it's correct. It's going to depend on who you ask, but I think, again, what Rambam would say is asking a historian is using the wrong methodology to discover that type of question.
And my second question, when the Rambam is talking about Maaseh Merkava and the Chachmos that are taught of the Seder, he's basically referring to Aristotle, isn't he?
He's referring to not Aristotle as a text, but he's referring to metaphysics. There's a big difference. In other words, when we use the word philosophy, maybe we'll come back to this another time, because I'd like to see this passage from Rav Kook. When we use the word philosophy, we could refer to a number of things. We could refer to the idea of using seichel to answer basic questions like, what is the cause for things that exist? We could refer to a group of texts like Aristotle and the commentaries. It could be referring to other types of questions. So we're using perhaps the word not precisely, and it might be worthwhile to come back to the question what exactly we're referring to. But what the Rambam says, Maaseh Merkava does not mean studying Aristotle. Maaseh Merkava means studying metaphysics, studying these basic questions of philosophy. And as we noted last time, not every philosophical question is also one that would have interest Rambam, but basically trying to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu and all that exists. Okay. So as I said, a second approach can be found in the writings of Rav Kook. If you turn to page 13 of the source books, this is a piece from Rav Kook known as L'Achduto Shel HaRambam. It was written to a letter written to Rav Zev Yavitz, who is an interesting fellow. He moved to Eretz Yisrael in 1988, and he published in a number of periodicals. And he was born in 1847. He died in 1924. And he basically was a Talmud Chacham, and he depicts Rambam's philosophical positions as being heavily influenced by non-Jewish sources. Essentially, the Rambam isn't a reflection of Jewish thought. And Rav Kook, we'll see, both minimizes the influence of non-Jewish sources and maximizes the extent to which the Rambam's approach does, in fact, fundamentally differ and diverge from that of the philosophers. Rav Kook's view does certainly differ from the conventional academic approach, and in fact seems at odds with some passages of the Rambam himself. I think there's something that's a very important nakuda here, and in fact actually some academics do in a certain sense accept it. But let's take a look at what he says. So first of all, second paragraph, Bidorosenu Vakama Dor Shalfanenu Shashaktu Haruchos Vishama Shatstaka Shalarambam Parsha Pirshes Ora Al Pine Kol Ofek Hayados Nichnas Gam Hamore Bichlal Sifriya Kodeshem Kinyane Torah. And in fact you'll find many of various thinkers, even Kabbalistic thinkers, quoting from Mor Nevuchim, whether it's Tanya or Nefesh HaChaim or the like. Mor Nevuchim, since the debate over the Rambam that existed in the Middle Ages has died down, so the Rambam has been accepted. Everybody sees the Rambam as a gadol b'Torah, and everybody's going to agree to that his opinion is, as he's going to say, a reflection of Kedusha, and even if that's not the approach that you happen to take. It's worth reading this whole letter, but we're late. I want to turn to the next page, 14, the paragraph. For lo nuchal b'shem ofen laskim l'divrei harav ha-mechaber zal v'meh shekasev b'pliyaso. This is, again, the mechaber, meaning the person he's responding to. And he basically says, skip to the end of that paragraph, ha-mechaber zal hivdil havdala tehomit. She'en l'malei mena be'etzem ha'mehush shel ha'Torah klapei chachmas yavan. V'zos hi ha'havdala she'bein kodesh l'chol. Acharei asher kava huzal shalosh yisodos ikariyim she'shum me'ayen b'sefer Mor Nevuchim lo yachol uzuz mehem. A lot of times people, Rav Kook says, understand the Rambam too narrowly. They're very narrow, and they see the Rambam narrowly. And that's why everybody sort of paints the Rambam in their own light. So philosophers paint the Rambam as a philosopher and argue that his halachic writings are not really what he really thought was important. I don't know, he wrote them for the masses, and it's not the ikar. And Balei Halacha focus on the Rambam's halacha, and the Mor Nevuchim he wrote, but it's not really who he was. And some people look at his leadership, communal leadership. The Rambam was very broad. And you have to look at the Rambam broadly. And if you look at the Rambam broadly, not just, some of the statements that he says in certain paragraphs, but broadly, holistically, what's he doing? And you understand also what the Greeks maintained. You will see, Rav Kook says, that the Rambam fundamentally rejected the Greek outlook and embraced that of Torah, recognized that Torah was different, and accepted the Torah. And he highlights then three ways in which you see this very powerfully. Ha'echad, the next paragraph, Ha'echad, Shanevuah hi lemala, mikol hamusag shel haseichal ha'enoshi kulam. The concept of prophecy is something that goes beyond anything that the human intellect is capable of at least arriving to on their own. Umashalo yusag klal b'seichal ha'anoshi arei hu noda bibiur al yedei nevuah shehi dvar Hashem. And this is something that it's not just it happens to go against Greek philosophy, but it's fundamentally at odds to Greek philosophy. Now, the truth is the Rambam's position on prophecy is complex. He has 17 chapters on it.
On
Nevuah, in Mor Nevuchim. And one aspect of this thought is, in fact, consistent with the Greek worldview, which is that prophecy is part of the natural process. In Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, for example, Parak Zayin, he writes that both intelligence and moral character are preconditions for philosophy. The spirit of philosophy only rests upon someone who's distinguished by great wisdom and moral character, whose passions never overcome him in anything whatsoever, but who by his rational faculty always has his passions under control and possesses broad and a sedate mind. But what is prophecy? So the Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim, it's a certain perfection in the nature of man. And it's one step beyond what a person can naturally achieve. So while the steps leading up to prophecy, the Rambam writes, are in fact natural, the last rung of that process, the final stage, is decidedly unnatural. And it's in this respect, Rav Kook writes, that the Rambam deviates sharply from the Greek perspective. The Greek perspective might have allowed for some notion of prophecy, but that prophecy is only, it is a natural process that is the natural result of both moral and intellectual perfection. And what the Rambam says is no. Moral and intellectual perfection are a prerequisite for prophecy, but that final step is supernatural. It's God's will. The way he writes it is, it may happen that one who is fit for prophecy and prepared for it should not become a prophet, namely on account of the divine will. Also, he writes that in Yesodia Torah, Perek Zayin. And what is it, according to the Rambam, that prophecy grants a person that he's not yet achieved? And the Rambam explains that when the divine intellect, or the divine overflow, reaches a person's intellect, so then he's a philosopher. But if the overflow reaches a person's imaginative faculty, so then he's a prophet. I'll just read to you a little bit from Mor Nevuchim 2:37. You should know that in the case in which the intellectual overflows only toward the rational faculty, you don't have this here, I'm sorry, and does not overflow at all towards the imaginative faculty, either because of the scantiness of what overflows or because of some deficiency existing in the imaginative faculty in its natural disposition, a deficiency that makes it impossible for it to receive the overflow of the intellect, is characteristic of men of science engaged in speculation, or philosophers. If, on the other hand, the overflow reaches both faculties, I mean both the rational and the imaginative, as we and others among the philosophers have explained, and if the imaginative faculty is in a state of ultimate perfection owing to its natural disposition, this characteristic is the class of prophets. Now, the Rambam here uses terminology that is philosophical terminology, and this is something I'd like to explain, though perhaps not today. I'm sorry, we started very late today. But the Rambam definitely borrows terminology from Aristotle, from the Greeks. But the conclusions, and he uses their tools of explanation and their terminology to explain concepts, but their conclusions, and we'll maybe try to explain what exactly means by these imaginative faculty and rational faculty, there are terms that are very hard to understand, but fundamentally the point is that his conclusion is radically different. Prophecy gives a person something that they can't achieve through their intellect alone. And thus, it's a radical departure from the Greek perspective insofar as A, prophecy is not just a natural process, and B, demonstrates that there's a form of perception inaccessible to mind, but accessible through this spiritual prophecy process. Point number two, Rav Kook. Hasheni, hu yisod chidush ha'olam, shebezeh akar es kol ha-mabat ha'alili ha-yevani al kol ha-havaya kula. So it's not just a small point that the Rambam rejects the Aristotle's notion of the eternity of matter, but this is a cataclysmically different worldview. According to the Aristotle, the universe exists and operates independently of God's will. the eternity of matter, and that's why the Rambam writes that rejecting the eternity of matter is not, it's not because of the psukim, the Rambam says, it's not because of the words Bereishis Bara Elokim. He says, I could explain those psukim that would allow for the eternity of matter. But it's because of the notion that if you accept the eternity of matter, then the universe operates independently of God's will. And the Torah clearly does not accept that, because in the Torah believes in Hashkacha. It believes in Nevuah. It believes... Right. Well, see what the Rambam says that means. But but Nisim are impossible. Nevuah is impossible. Every Pasuk in the Torah, not every Pasuk, half the Pasukim in the Torah are impossible according to the Aristotelian perspective. According to the Rambam, as he writes at the beginning of Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, God is the source for all that exists. And that's why the Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim that the entire basis of the Torah, that's in Chelek Beis Parak Chaf Dalet, is inconceivable according to Aristotle's perspective. And finally, I guess we're a little late, so just skip to the next paragraph. Ha'yisod HaShlishi, Hu Yisod HaHashgacha HaPratis, B'min HaAdam, B'chol Pratav U'ma'asav. Shehu ha-hepech ha-gamor mikol tzivyon ha-hakara shel chachmas yavan. Rambam's view on hashgacha is in fact complex. I'd like to have a chance to study it this year, but the Greek view on hashgacha was what the Rambam writes characterized by the pasuk Yechezkel of Azav Elokim es haaretz. There is no such thing as hashgacha. And the Rambam writes that providence, hashgacha, is predicated on creation, and that there is such a thing as hashgacha pratis. Now, the Rambam writes it's only possible for man and not beast, because it reflects man's elevated state, and the Rambam writes that a person who's achieved a more elevated state will be zocha to a higher level of hashgacha, and will have a chance to learn what Rambam's view on hashgacha is. But there is a notion of hashgacha pratis, whatever it is, whatever it applies to. And the idea that God has controls or is involved in the world, communicates to the world, all that is fundamental for the Rambam and for Torah, and at odds with Greek philosophy. So of course Rav Kook acknowledges that the Rambam appropriates much wisdom from Aristotle, but he did not follow Aristotle and his Arabic philosophical commentators blindly, but he investigated, distinguished, and refined matters, and after it became clear that there were no fundamental contradictions, so then he did not hide the truth, but instead he declared what he received from them and how they shed new light on the Torah. So there is a lot of admiration from Rambam on Aristotle, and he frequently accepts many of his positions. But it is not the same. Fundamentally, Rav Kook writes, and again, I really urge you to read this piece. It's a beautiful piece, and it's not hard to read. It's not like some of others' writings of Rav Kook. Fundamentally, the Rambam is a presentation of the Torah. He accepts the Torah when it's at odds with philosophy, and fundamentally, the Torah's worldview is fundamentally different than that of Greek philosophy. Now, this raises an interesting question, because the Rambam does, in fact, I'll just tell you one maybe interesting ironic point. You could do with it as you wish. But I refer to a thinker who argues in favor of what's known as an esoteric reading of the Rambam, where the Rambam doesn't really mean a lot of what he says, and the Rambam was really a closet Aristotelian. So an introduction to two contemporary thinkers who are who argue for that perspective is Shlomo Pinis and Strauss. And Strauss writes an introduction. Leo Strauss, famous from the University of Chicago, writes an introduction to the Pinas translation of the Mar Nevuchim, in which he articulates his view. And he writes a fascinating thing. The enchanting character of the guide does not appear immediately. At first glance, the book appears merely to be strange and in particular to lack order and consistency. But progress in understanding it is a progress in becoming enchanted by it. Understanding it is perhaps the highest form of edification. Now here's the fascinating point. One begins to understand the guide once one sees that it is not a philosophical book, a book written by a philosopher for philosophers, but a Jewish book, a book written by a Jew for Jews. In other words, you'll only understand Mar Nevuchim if you realize it's not a philosophical work, it's not written by a philosopher, it's a book of Torah written for Jews. Now, he happens to think that that's not the Rambam's opinion, and the Rambam doesn't believe what he reads in Mar Nevuchim. But he agrees with Rav Kook. They both read Mar Nevuchim the same way. It's just that it's not a philosophical book written by a philosopher. It's a book of Torah written for Jews. It's just that Rav Kook thinks that the Rambam meant what he said. Maybe we'll talk more about that next week.
That was Strauss.
It was a direct quote from the introduction. I'm not advocating reading it. But if you were to read it, that's what you would find. Now, I thought an interesting insight that Matt Lubin pointed out to me. The insight I saw is also made by Dr. John Inglis in a book called Medieval Philosophy and the Classical Tradition in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, as well as Frank and Lehman in the Cambridge Companion to Medieval Jewish Philosophy. They all make the same point. They quote, which is that... they quote a scholar of actually Aquinas, and Thomas Aquinas also quotes a lot of Aristotle. And he writes, "We find many references of Aristotle and Thomas. We find the invocation of doctrines, the quoting of phrases. He is using the doctrines of language or language of Aristotle for his own purposes. It is almost as if Aristotle were a language Thomas used to make independent points of his own." And these scholars argue that Rambam does the same thing. He uses Aristotle to present ideas of Torah, just like later scholars use Rambam's language to express their own ideas. And they're often attributed to the Rambam, even though they're not quite what the Rambam writes. So Rambam was not a closet Aristotelian. He uses Aristotle frequently, but for his own purposes. Like we saw, Nevuah, as Rambam understood it, is fundamentally at odds with Nevuah as Aristotle understood it, to the extent that he could have accepted it. But he uses Aristotelian terminology to explain the Torah's conception of Nevuah, the imaginative faculties and the intellectual faculties and whatever those things mean. But fundamentally, there's a difference. So we've presented here today, and we'll develop this next week, God willing, two very different attitudes towards understanding the Rambam's relationship to Greek philosophy. There's no doubt that Rambam was indebted to Greek philosophy. He thought it was very valuable. But was the Rambam basically arguing that there's compatibility and they're both correct for the most part, except for some minor differences? That's certainly the pashut pshat in the Rambam. Or Rav Kook's argument, which is that Rambam accepted the Torah, and their Torah and Greek philosophy are fundamentally at odds. Rambam used Greek philosophy and thought highly of it, but fundamentally Rambam's outlook is kadosh, Aristotle was chol, and really lo karav zeh el zeh. Have a good Shabbos.